in next week. I decided this chapter was kind of that important that it warranted a couple of goes at it. So this week is Giant Slayer Part 1, and next week will be Giant Slayer Part 2. So Adrian Goliath is, as you're no doubt aware, one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. You are introduced, if you grow up in a Christian home, it's one of those stories you'll be introduced to as a kid in your children's Bible, probably with some nice pictures to go with it. And even if Bible reading the Bible is a new thing for you, this is a story that you might have just heard of through, you know, general popular culture or whatever it might be. The story of David and Goliath has all the components of a great tale. There's a terrifying villain, there's an unlikely hero, and there's a victory against the odds. But it's not just a good yarn, it is an historical event, or it wasn't an historical event, of massive significance. See, this was the time when David burst onto the scene in Israel. He went from being a nobody, suddenly he caught the public eye, came to public attention. And so it was an event that would resonate in the collective memory of Israel and would set the tone for David's kingship when indeed he took the throne. Now, as Jen mentioned, we're kind of launching into the middle of a series of talks on 1 Samuel. I think it might actually have been 2 years ago that I spoke on chapters 1 to 16. So most of you probably weren't even here then, and if you were, you probably can't remember them anyway. So I don't want to really assume that you're familiar with the book of 1 Samuel. So I want to give you just a little brief introduction before we get into this chapter. 1 Samuel is a book about kings. A slide's going to come up on the screen. This is my little summary of 1 Samuel. Actually, I've kind of ripped it off a bit, but anyway. Chapters 1 to 7 are about the idea that God is king. Sometimes in Israel's history, and sometimes in 1 Samuel chapters 1 to 7, you see that Israel have bad human leaders, and sometimes they have good human leaders, but ultimately their destiny is in God's hands. It's in God's hands. He is their king, and he can protect them. And so we learn in those early chapters of Samuel that it's best for Israel when they acknowledge God as their king and trust him. However, in chapter 8, we reread that Israel rejects God as their king and asks for another king. They demand a king because they want to be like the other nations. And so God gave them a king named Saul. And after some initial and fairly short-lived success, Saul's kingship, at least in the eyes of the writer of 1 Samuel, Saul's kingship was a failure. He acted foolishly. He disobeyed God, and so ultimately God rejected him as king. And in chapter 16, just before the chapter we read today, in chapter 16 we're introduced to a boy who would be king, named David. Chapter 16 describes these extraordinary circumstances in which God instructs the prophet Samuel to anoint David as king, to sort of symbolise that he's king by pouring oil on his head, to anoint him as king while King Saul is still alive. And so for the remainder of the book of 1 Samuel, we've got this remarkable situation where there are, in a sense, two kings. One is actually ruling Israel, although has already been rejected by God. And the other is chosen by God, and we're going to see what's going on with him as we read this book together. But as we pay careful attention to 1 Samuel chapter 17, we might learn some significant things a bit further about what these two kings were like, Saul and David. Well, 1 Samuel 16 has introduced us to David as the boy who would be king, but then curiously, at the start of chapter 17, David drops from the picture. And for the first 11 verses, and instead our attention is focused on a war brewing in the western hill country of Judah. So look at verse 1 with me. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soko in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Soko and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. Now we meet here, but first we meet the enemy, the Philistines. The Philistines are in fact the main aggressor in the book of 1 Samuel, sort of from the close to the beginning to the end. There's a map that's going to come up that will show you the Philistines lived to the west, on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. They lived just to the west of Israel. That's the land of Israel, marked by Israel and Judah. Judah's one of the tribes of Israel. And they lived there. They had five main cities. They're those circles in red in that Philistine territory there. And the red arrows there are showing some of their military incursions into Israel during this period. So we've got the Philistines. So, and now the second thing we see in verse 1 is their activity. The Philistines, we're told in verse 1, they gathered their forces for war and assembled at Soko in Judah. Gathered and assembled there are two different forms of the same Hebrew word, asaf, that's the Hebrew word. They're amassing their troops for battle. And they march into Israelite territory, into some of the tribal territory of Judah. You can see Soko on the map there, or go back, thanks Dan, just over where there's that sort of notional border between Philistine territory and Israel. They've marched into the land of Israel there, Soko and Azekah. And they gather for battle. And verse 2 describes the battlefield. The battlefield is the valley of Elah. And now you can see this next photo. This is a photo of the valley of Elah. And we're told in verse 3 that it's the Israelite army kind of assembled on one hill and the Philistines assembled on another hill with the valley in between them. Now you can see just from the picture photo there how hilly that this section of the land of Israel is. So the valley of Elah is kind of a really strategic entry point for the Philistine army into Israel. It's thereby like a really critical position to defend if you're an Israelite. And these armies assembled themselves on the hill outside, or hills on either side of this valley. But as we're told in verse 1 and 2, it's something that that some translations kind of miss. There's a difference between these two armies as they get organised. I think I put another translation on the screen. I have, ESV. There's ESV. Verse 1, now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. Notice the difference there in verse 2, and Saul and the men of Israel were gathered. Can you see a subtle difference in that word there? The Philistine lords take this active role in leadership. They take initiative. They gather their troops for battle. But in verse 2, that same verb is used in the passive voice. And Saul is just lumped in with the rest of the men of Israel as part of the group that was gathered. We see, on the one hand, this active, aggressive, initiative-taking Philistine army, and this perhaps more passive leadership on the part of King Saul. Well, are we reading too much into Saul's passivity here? Well, let's read on and find out. From verses 4 to 11, we see the enemy. Now with these two armies arranged on the two hills and the valley in between, then verse 4, a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. So you can picture in your mind, can't you, this one man, or it turned out it was two men, walking out into the middle of the valley, this Philistine champion. We're given a little biographical info about Goliath, his name, Goliath, that he's from Gath, which was one of those five main cities of the Philistines, and in fact the one that was closest to Judah and closest to this particular battlefield. Given this biographical info, the Israelites might not have seen, they just see this man walking towards them across the valley. But one of the striking features of this verse is the Hebrew phrase that's used, it's translated as champion. Champion. Literally, that Hebrew phrase means the man of the between. The man of the between. See, it's describing what Goliath is doing right then. He's this seasoned veteran, this professional soldier, whose job it was to advance out into no man's land between the two armies and issue a challenge. That's Goliath. this man of the betweens, in a sense claiming this territory between the two armies as his own. And as we read on, we get this description of what Goliath is like, and we come to understand why the Philistines have picked him for this job. So look at him. He was over 9 feet tall. He was over 9. This guy was enormous. Enormous. In Hebrew, it's 6 cubits and a span. It's just under 9 feet, 9 inches, just under 3 metres. We're talking about a guy who is 3 metres tall, or close to it. It's massive. Now, a basketball ring, I understand, is 10 feet off the ground. So if Goliath is 9 feet, 9 inches tall, then if he was standing under a basketball ring, his head would be in the net. You know, he can just reach up and dunk a ball without even moving. He's so massive, it's unbelievable. And I thought, is this for real? I mean, can a guy be this big? Well, one option is that maybe he wasn't. So there are a few manuscripts that put his height at 4 cubits in a span rather than 6 cubits in a span. So that would be about 205 centimetres, which is still pretty darn big. Could he be 3 metres tall? Well, there are a few other men in recent centuries who have approached that. They've come pretty close. So there's American actor Robert Wardlow. He was 272 centimetres tall. I mean, look at him next to that other bloke there. He's a giant. And John Middleton, that's a grave of a guy called John Middleton who lived in the 15th and 16th centuries in England. And his gravestone says he was 9 feet 3 inches tall, so which is 282 centimetres. And there are other passages in the Old Testament which speak of men of giant stature being around at this same period of time as well. So while Goliath's stature was alarming, let me suggest it wasn't, even if it is 3 metres, it's not completely infeasible. This is a guy, a soldier, who was for all intents and purposes a giant. He was a giant. Thanks, Dan. And look at verse 5. Verse 5 then goes on to describe how he's armed. Verse 5. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armour of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. His head and upper body are covered in this massively heavy armour. 5,000 shekels is about 57 kilograms. And his legs are armoured too. Verse 6, on his legs he wore bronze greaves. It's like armoured plates on his legs. Here's a guy. He's this walking fortress. Verse 6 again. There was a bronze javelin slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His spear bearer went ahead of him. He's got this full armour. He's got a shield bearer walking in front of him who's carrying a shield that's probably a full body length shield. Maybe not Goliath's body length, I don't know, but like a big shield. This is what it takes a guy to carry it for him. He's fully armoured, fully protected, perhaps only his face exposed where he can see. And he's got this impressive weaponry, a spear with a heavy iron head, and another weapon stuck on his back, which NIV suggests is a javelin. It might be a javelin, it might be like something like a curved sword, like a scimitar or something like that. But just imagine the sheer presence of this guy on the battlefield, this walking fortress with not a single chink in his defences. I mean, he's coming toward the Israelite army, this impenetrable, unstoppable juggernaut. And he walks out into no man's land and he issues a challenge. Look at verse 8. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." See, Goliath's whole tone here he's just mocking. He's mocking Israel. In verse 8, he appraises the situation there in the Valley of Elah, and he emphatically contrasts the two armies. He says there, which is, "Am I not the Philistine?" He says, "I'm the Philistine. And what about you? You are mere slaves of Saul." Saul's slaves. Would Saul's slaves dare come out and fight against me, the Philistine? In verse 10, again he's called the Philistine. In fact, he's only called Goliath twice in this chapter. Most of the time he's called the Philistine. And there he says, "I defy the ranks of Israel." That word there, defy, is one of the key words in this chapter. It means something like to mock, to scorn, to reproach. It occurs six times, or word like it. See, Goliath stands there and he mocks Israel. This scornful giant, the Philistine, issues a challenge. And the essence of his challenge is there in verse 8. He says, "Choose a man and have him come down to me. Choose a man and have him come down to me." But hang on a second. That challenge, "Choose a man and have him come down to me," that challenge should be ringing some bells in our ears. Because Israel had already chosen a man.
I hope I've got this on the screen. Go to the next slide and see if I do.
1 Samuel 8, verse 18 to 20. Where Samuel's speaking to them about the king. He talks in verse 18 about the king you have chosen for yourselves. And the people say in verse 19, "We want a king." Why do they want a king, verse 20? "We want a king to be like the other nations, and we want a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles." See, this is the man they'd chosen, King Saul. A king who would go out before them and fight their battles for them. See, this was his moment. Or go to the next slide, 1 Samuel 10, verse 23 and 24. This is the moment when Saul is kind of first introduced to the people as their king. We read there in verse 23 that he stood among the people. As he stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. And Samuel said of him, "There is no one like him among all the people." Yeah, sure, Saul maybe didn't quite attain to Goliath's intimidating stature, but he was at least a head taller than anyone else in Israel. This was sort of as good as you were going to find in Israel. And this was the man they had chosen to fight their battles. See, didn't Israel already have their champion? Isn't this his moment? Where's Saul? Shouldn't he be striding forward to fight Goliath? Look at verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Let me sort of say it's in the word order it is there in the Hebrew, something approximating the word order. It says, "And Saul heard, and all Israel, these words of the Philistine, and they were dismayed and greatly afraid." See, Saul heard, and all Israel heard, and they were afraid. And then the narrative shifts. It kind of leaves us poised there with that tension still hovering in the air, with the taunts and the terrors of the Valley of Elah, and suddenly the narrative takes us somewhere else. If this were a modern novel, this would be the chapter break where it's, you know, just built up to that climax point, that kind of moment, and suddenly there's a chapter break and you're reading about a different character. Or if it were a television show, this would be the commercial break followed by a new and seemingly unrelated scene when the program resumes. We're taken off somewhere else. And verse 12 starts, "Now David." Now David. Look at verse 12. "Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was old and well advanced in years. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So suddenly we get this kind of drawn-out introduction of David. In fact, it's an introduction that repeats some of the material that we already know from chapter 16. It's like there's this deliberate attempt to slow down the narrative. We're left with this unresolved tension in the Valley of Elah and then taken off to meet David, the youngest of 8 brothers, to this old man Jesse who lives in Bethlehem. Verse 14, the youngest is equally the same word for the smallest. And likewise, the word for the oldest in verse 14 is the same word for the largest. This little boy David, shepherd boy in Bethlehem. In fact, when the prophet Samuel first spotted David's oldest brother Eliab, he was impressed by Eliab's stature, his size. But here we meet little David and his brothers. Now Bethlehem was about 19 kilometres east of the Valley of Elah, the present battlefield. And verse 15 here implies that for some time David had been kind of a messenger between his 3 oldest brothers who were in Saul's army and his father's house, going backwards and forwards. When he's at home tending his father's flock at Bethlehem. But after these verses spent introducing David, we've given this introduction in 12 to 15, but we haven't been told of any specific action of David or anyone else yet, other than sort of background information. And then we're taken back to the Valley of Elah in verse 16. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Every day, twice a day, the same scenario played out. Each day would begin and end with the Philistines' defiance and the Israelites' terror. This battle's at a standstill while the Philistine just marches forward and mocks and scoffs. And then we're taken back to David. And what we're told of is a mundane and fairly innocuous task which his father assigns him, but a task which is about to entangle the destinies of these 2 men. Verse 17. Now Jesse said to his son David, take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them. They're with Saul and all the men of Israel in the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. See, Jesse assigns his son David this simple task of being a delivery boy and a messenger. Jesse comes across as a typical father who's concerned about his sons who are away at war and who wants to do what he can to sort of butter up their son's commanding officer so that maybe, you know, it'll go a bit better for them in the camp or whatever. And he's a father who understands, he's desperate to receive some assurance of the welfare of his son, so he sends off David. Now verse 19 suggests that this was probably David's first trip to the Valley of Elah. Maybe he'd made other trips elsewhere when the army was elsewhere. But it was his first trip to the Valley of Elah because Jesse tells him where they are. Either that or Jesse just thinks David's a twit. Anyway, verse 20, early in the morning David left the flock with a shepherd, loaded up and set out as Jesse had directed. See, we're given just more detail in the narrative that sort of slows it down. David's every move is that he left the flock with a shepherd, he loaded up, he set out. Perhaps a picture here of David leaving behind an old life for a new destiny that awaits. Verse 20, he reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. See, in the providence of God, just as David arrives, the armies are drawing up as they've done every day for the last 40 days, facing each other. The standoff continues. And verse 22, David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines and greeted his brothers. Again, as he'd left behind the sheep, he leaves these other things with a keeper and he asks after his brothers at the battle lines. He has fulfilled his filial duties to his father. He completed the task set for him. Unless perhaps there still remains that third element to bring back some token or sign from the battlefield that would assure Jesse of the welfare of his sons. I wonder what kind of assurance David might find to take back. But as he's discharged this ordinary task for his father, this duty has brought David to the front line of battle at just the moment when that familiar scene was about to unfold. Verse 23. As he was talking with them, with his brothers, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. See, everything occurred just as before. Goliath, the man of the between, stepped out into no man's territory and issued this mocking challenge. Like the previous 40 days and 40 nights, here was this embarrassing daily ritual. Exactly the same as all the days before. Only this time with one difference. And David heard. In fact, in verse 23, we're kind of reintroduced to Goliath, in a sense because we're seeing this scene, this whole scene, afresh with new eyes, as David catches his first glimpse of the Philistine. And David heard. The Israelite response, however, is predictable. Verse 24, when the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. Again, they see this armoured behemoth coming towards them and they flee in terror. Now, as you can imagine, with kind of 40 days on the front line with nothing much happening except this daily dose of terror, the Israelites had little to do except play cards and talk about Goliath. And verse 25, we see this is just what's going on. Goliath, the Philistine, he's the talk of the Israelite camp. Verse 25. Now, the Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. Now, one of the things I find curious about this verse is we don't actually hear anything from King Saul himself. Where is Saul? What's Saul doing? We're not told. Did Saul in fact make this offer? Or is this just the kind of rumour that 40 days of speculation might feed? Well, we're not sure. David apparently hadn't heard this news yet, because in verse 26 he asks, what will be done for the man who kills Goliath? And in verse 27 and then again in verse 30, the men around him answer along the same lines of this offer. There will be a big prize for whoever can defeat Goliath. We still haven't heard from King Saul, but this is the word on the street, at least, is in agreement. A big prize for whoever can defeat Goliath. Well, where does that leave us? Well, in closing, what I want to do, I just want to draw together some threads, some things which I've picked up, some things which I've passed over. I want to draw together some threads to focus your attention on the issue of perception. The issue of perception. The perception is a major theme in this passage. Now look at verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Verse 24, when the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. Verse 25, the Israelites have been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? Verse 23, and David heard. See, this idea of perception is one of the key ideas here. What do people perceive as they see Goliath marching out from the Philistine ranks towards them? Well, we know that David has seen. We know that David has heard. But what has he perceived? There are three key men involved in the exchanges in verse 25 to 30. First, there is David's oldest brother, Eliab. When the prophet Samuel first saw Eliab, as I mentioned earlier, this is what he saw. Chapter 16, look back in the Bible, chapter 16, verse 6. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." When the prophet Samuel first saw Eliab, he saw as man sees. He saw the outward appearance. He saw Eliab's stature, his height. But God tells Samuel, that is not how the Lord sees. But what about Eliab? What about David? Second person, Eliab. David's the second person. What about David? What did Eliab perceive when he heard David? Look at verse 28. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." See, what does Eliab perceive when he sees or he hears David? He perceives an annoying younger brother, a pest, a nuisance, a little boy who has no place in the front line of battle, no place in man's business. This insignificant youth with an insignificant job, looking after just a few mangy sheep, and even that insignificant job he couldn't really be trusted to do well. Now, in a staggering display of arrogance, Eliab even thinks Eliab can perceive as God perceives. He thinks he can see into David's heart. In fact, in this verse, Eliab comes across pretty much the same as Goliath. He even asked the same question of David that Goliath had asked of the Israelites in verse 8. "Why have you come?" He demonstrates the same arrogant assurance of his own superiority. As Goliath looked at the Israelites as pathetic slaves, so Eliab looks at his younger brother and sees only this troublesome little kid. Eliab, David, or what about the third man, Goliath? The man on everyone's mind, the man of the betweens, the Philistine from Gath. What did people perceive when they saw Goliath? Well, we know what Saul and the Israelites perceived. This indomitable, invincible juggernaut, this gargantuan Philistine. What about David? What did David perceive? Verse 26. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" See, David cuts to the heart of the matter, this disgrace, this reproach that's poured out by Goliath on Israel. But here David says it's not the armies of Israel that this Philistine's defying. It's not the armies of Saul that this Philistine's defying. He is defying the armies of the living God. David heard Goliath's taunts, and David perceived a fool. A proud, arrogant, blasphemous fool. A fool who had no concept of what he was doing. And like a boy poking a bear with a stick or hitting a beehive, here Goliath was provoking a power he couldn't comprehend and against which he could not stand. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? The first time God's been mentioned in this chapter. Ultimately, David saw a doomed fool. There's no doubt in David's mind that this Philistine would die. Just a question about who would be the one to do it. See, in this whole chapter, there's only one person whose perception matched reality. Only one person who considered the most important factor in any situation we might face, the living God. Do you know what the most common command in the Bible is? The most frequent command in the Bible? What do you think it might be? Love God, worship Him, obey Him. The most common command, so I understand, I haven't counted myself, the most common command is do not fear. Do not fear. You know the living God, so do not fear. Turn quick forward in your Bibles and think of Psalm 118. See, why is it that we should not fear? Why was it that Saul and Israel should not have feared that day in the Valley of Elah? Why was it that David did not fear? Psalm 118, verse 6. Psalm 118, verse 6. The Lord is with me. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? The Lord is with me. He is my helper. I will look in triumph on my enemies. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. See, what's the basis of the command not to fear? The basis is the presence of the living God with us. This is what Israel and Saul should have known, and it's what Goliath himself should have paused to consider. He is with us. He is for us. He is my helper. So much of our life we can be ruled by fear. What is it that you fear? Earlier this year I tried to come up with a list of things that uni students fear. This is what I came up with on my list. I don't know how accurate it is. I ran it by a few students earlier today. It seemed to be not too far from us. Things uni students fear. Failure. Loneliness. Rejection. Pain. Powerlessness. Boredom. Responsibility. Is there something you fear on that list? Now, a surprising number of those fears revolve around a fear of what other people might do to us. Now, when are we afraid? When do we fear? We fear when something we cherish, something we prize, is threatened. It might be our status, it might be our dignity, our feelings of self-worth, our popularity, our enjoyment of life, whatever it might be. We fear when something that we prize is threatened. But if you're a believer in Jesus, all the most important things are completely secure. You have a relationship with God that does not depend on your performance, and so you need have no fear of failure. You have a status as God's son, which has been given to you by God's grace, and so you need have no fear of rejection with God. And you have an inheritance which can never perish, spoil or fade, kept in heaven for you. An eternal hope, a secure hope, and so you need not fear the fleeting pain and suffering of this life. See, the only way to drive out fear of all the things we're afraid of, and other people, is to remember this, the living God. If He is with you, what can man do to you? What need you fear? Our real enemies, though, are not other people. And our real enemies, really, at the end of the day, are not loneliness or rejection or pain or whatever else man might inflict on you. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, we see a picture of God saving His people from their enemies. And our enemies, yours and mine, are not the Philistines, and they're not Goliath, and they're not your atheist lecturer who mocks Christians, and they're not any man or woman. Our only real enemies are those things which might separate us from God. Sin. Death. Satan and his accusations. Hell. See, these are fearsome and terrifying enemies indeed. They're enemies which seem unyielding and seem unconquerable. For who can overcome his sin? Who can conquer death? Who can stand against Satan? Who can avoid hell? and yet they're all enemies that our Lord Jesus Christ has defeated. They're enemies that Jesus has nailed to the cross. They're enemies that now hold no fear for us because they have been overcome. He who did not spare his own son but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Amen.